Liam Caffrey has a new book out called The Best Year Ever. The subtitle is One Guy, One Year, 12 Once-in-a-Lifetime Adventures. Among those adventures, going to a party at the Playboy Mansion, running with the Bulls in Pamplona, throwing out the first pitch at a Major League Baseball game, playing golf at St. Andrews in Scotland, and playing in a tournament at the World Series of Poker. I've had a great time reading this book over the last few days, and I've asked him to join us here today. Hi, Liam. How are you?
Good, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
Who chose the activities that you did over the course of this year?
Yeah, so I chose them. I sat down. I mean, the background on the book was a little bit of, at the time I set out to write it, I was in my mid-30s. I was, to all outward appearances, doing really well, great job, great friends, living in Chicago. But I really felt like I was stuck in a bit of a rut, that I was just head down day-to-day working, wasn't really taking time to enjoy life and sort of seeing things pass me by. And so I thought, listen, why don't I stop and lay out what are 12 things I've always wanted to do in life and try to see could I get them done all within a calendar year. So I sat down and I made a list, and it was a mix of things that I'd always wanted to do. Some of them were intensely personal to me. Some of them were things that, might have been on anybody's bucket list. But it was something that was personal to me, and I kind of crafted at the beginning of the year and then planned out how could I achieve them all throughout the course of that year.
Well, you say in the book that at the time you were working, and you just mentioned you had a good job.
Yep.
But your job was destroying America, Liam.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, I was a consultant. I worked in financial services, and so I did a little bit of everything.
You worked for a subprime mortgage guy, and that's the people who ruined America.
Yeah, there was a time I actually didn't work for the subprime company, but I worked for somebody that bought a subprime company, and they were trying to figure out what to do with it. And so for a while, we were in what I kind of call the engine room of doom of the economy before we realized it.
That's what I'm talking about. All right. Yep. I just wanted to get that out there. Let's leave it behind and move on to the one that I think a lot of middle-aged guys like us would want to know about first, and that is going to a party at the Playboy Mansion, which I'm guessing in the 21st century isn't quite as cool as it would have been, 50 years ago.
Yeah, that was one of those where it's funny, when I describe the book, everyone seizes on that chapter. It's obviously a very popular topic, and everybody wants to know what it's like. And at the time, again, as you say, you're a 30-something single guy, and you think, hey, let's go to the Playboy Mansion. I'd say it's one of the funnier chapters in the book, in my opinion. It was a fun experience in some sense, but as you say, it definitely was probably a little different in the 70s and 80s than it was today. I think today you can go into any club in Vegas on a Saturday night and probably have a wilder time than you could have at the Playboy Mansion. So it felt a little bit cliched. I'm glad I did it. It was a fun story, fun experience, I think good to write about. But I definitely, if you're looking for a good time, I'd almost say you could go to Vegas and do it a little bit better than the Playboy Mansion. Having said that, I mean, I got to give it up to Hugh Hefner. I mean, he was in his 80s at the time, and he's out there partying, so the man still brings it when he needs to.
All right, but let's go back to Hef here for just a second here.
Yep.
I get the impression from the book that you were a little bit disappointed in Hef that night because he kind of looked like a guy in his 80s at a party where he didn't belong.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely, I felt a little bit bad for him. He almost felt like, somebody at the zoo. He's in the mansion, and then, most of the parties take place outside, and they sort of parade him out behind velvet ropes, and he sits there with a half dozen playmates. But it was, it's 11 o'clock on a Saturday night, and you think the guy's 85. He probably wants to go to bed. So he definitely puts on a game show, but it's you a little bit feel bad for him, and it's a little bit like, the old lion in the zoo. You sort of just want him to be able to go back in the cave and relax.
Yeah, the zoo mixed with a Weekend at Bernie's vibe.
Yeah, he's not quite that, but you can definitely, he's getting up there.
I love something you write about here on page 77 of your book when you're describing the women who you ran into that night and the different kinds of women. And then you get to a bunch of women who had more tattoos than your average motorcycle gang. Quote, one of the girls was topless and had a tattoo of a topless girl on her back. Take that, M.C. Escher.
It was a bit of a mind bender. You definitely see some interesting sights out there. And so folks that you can tell, they are professional party goers, and they kind of dressed apart.
Were you thinking ahead of time, I'm going to go to the Playboy Mansion and get laid in the grotto?
No, I don't know that anybody, I think even myself, I thought, listen, these are fairly curated events anymore. This is not the swinging 70s. So, I mean, set aside the fact that I think a few years after I was there, they found Legionnaire's disease in the grotto.
Yeah.
So I was pretty glad. I mean, you definitely don't go in thinking that's going to happen. You sort of realize it's a bit of a staged environment and a club environment. But again, it's still an experience, but one that I've been there, done that. Wouldn't say I'd want to do it again.
When you look back on it, do you check the disappointment box for that one?
Yeah, again, I'd say as an experience for writing the book, I thought it was a great experience, and it ended up being a great story. In terms of, would it make the top list of, experiences and happier or most kind of joyous experiences I had through the book? No, it actually was towards the bottom and a bit more of a disappointment versus, what you would have hoped.
That's what I thought. Now, there's another one in the book that fits that same criteria. And by the way, I've shared this experience, and that is going to play at a tournament at the World Series of Poker. In your case, it wasn't the main event. In my case, it was the main event, but we both walked away not winning any money and feeling like we just paid to be bored for a while, right?
Yeah, that's another one where, again, the headline is, oh, World Series of Poker, it's a great event. And I play a lot of poker, and it's part of it is you're in it for the camaraderie and the experience, and you win some, you lose some, but it's a fun experience. And I think you watch even poker on TV in the World Series of Poker, and you get that same impression that there's a lot of, I'm all in, I'm going to stand up, they ring a bell, it's salvation on the river, et cetera. And I found you get there and it's a sea of humanity. Everyone plays very tight. It's actually, you don't realize how, when you watch it on TV, they edit it so carefully, it makes it look like every hand goes to the river and has a big climax to it. What you don't realize is most of the hands, I mean, we were lucky if we saw a flop. Everybody folded. They play so tight. It's impossible to get a read on anybody at the table. So it's almost like you're sitting for a math exam. You're just sitting there playing the odds. Everyone's playing the odds. There's no discussion. Hands are running around at lightning speed. And again, it's almost like you're sitting for the SAT. And so you play the odds, and I played the odds, and I lost on a hand where I should have won, and then I was short stacked, and I kind of was out pretty quickly. And you walk away, and you're like, wow, I just, wasted several hours of my life doing math exercises in my head. I'm not sure what I learned.
That's right. And the social aspect of the game is completely absent. When I played, I made it to day two of the main event, and on that second day, no one at my table said anything other than raise and an amount. No complete sentences were used all day long.
Yes, exactly. Half the people have headphones in, sunglasses on. It's just, they're just running math in their head. There is absolutely no social dynamic to it, which, again, is part of, as an amateur, part of why I play the game.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And I've been playing poker a long time, and when I finally got there, I didn't put up the $10,000 myself. I got in through a $200 satellite, and I thought, okay, well, here's my chance, like a friend of mine did, and he ran deep and made a lot of money, but for me, it was just boring in retrospect.
Yep.
Let's move on to something a little bit more exciting. You took part in an event that I actually consider one of the crueler things to go on in the world on a regular basis. That's a long list, I know. But you went to Pamplona, Spain,
yep,
for the running of the bulls.
Yep. Yeah, that was one of the events, I think, a highlight. I mean, obviously, you kind of set aside a little bit of the it is a cultural event that goes back centuries in Spain. So there are differing opinions on the cruelty of it in terms of, yes, at the end of the day, the bulls that run fight in the arena, and they get killed in the arena. So your opinion of bullfighting will skew, how you view the event. But it's a cultural experience in that region of Spain. It goes back hundreds of years. People take it very seriously. And I really studied for it. I mean, I went over there and I studied the culture. I studied the route. There are seven different discrete sections of the route over the course of a half mile. They each have their different pluses and minuses and dangers in terms of running with them. And then ran one morning with them. And that was one where it blows you away. You watch it on TV, and it doesn't convey how big and fast these animals are. I mean, you're standing there in the street in a fairly narrow side street with 2,000 other people, and a half ton to three quarter ton animal six of them come sprinting around a corner at you going 20 miles an hour. And it's like playing in traffic. And you really don't run with the bulls for that long. You kind of have to start running before they get to you, and you try to run next to them for a while. But, you know, that was one where, I mean, there's real danger. I mean, the day I ran, it was a fairly pedestrian event. The bull stayed in tight formation. It was a fast run. Nobody really got gored. The next day, somebody died. And it was actually the first time somebody had been killed since, I think, 1995 in the bull run. And again, it was a place where I debated, should I run in that section? So a very safe spot one day could be deadly the next day, and you're just dealing with, you know, humans and wild animals, and it's there's real danger involved. But that was one where, again, the whole culture and the experience of it was one of the highlights of the year.
Well, you make it sound like running with the bulls is a much better idea than running from the bulls.
Yeah, I mean, you're all running from the bulls in some way, but it's kind of, I mean, funny. I mean, they're going 20 miles an hour, and so you can't keep up with them for very long. You got to try to time it. There's a crowd, and so, again, you can get tripped and pushed. And actually, I think the other humans are more of a danger sometimes than the bulls are.
Ah.
But you're trying to get with them, and then you get knocked down. They tell you stay down. A lot of the people that really get gored, it's they fall down and they get up and they get a horn in the back. So they tell you if you fall down, stay down. It's better to get trampled than to get gored.
Oh.
But it's an experience, I'll tell you.
Did you speak to people who had done this many times before for some advice?
I did. You know, I read books, I read blogs, I talked to some people. You know, what you'll find is there's obviously a contingent of Spaniards that actually have running clubs, peñas, and they'll run every day and every year, and they'll have their own jerseys and things like that. And then there's a number of folks, you know, predominantly Brits and Americans, who will tend to go over on a regular basis. You try to pick up things from them. But, I mean, the funny thing is I saw this year there was a guy from Chicago that's running it, wrote a book about it, and he got gored. And so, again, even if you know exactly what's going on, there's a huge element of randomness to it in terms of who's safe and who gets hit in this thing.
It occurs to me that this event could never take place in the United States, and not just because of animal rights activists putting a stop to it, but because lawyers would never let you do this without signing a 52-page liability waiver.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's another question I get a lot is, did you have to sign a waiver to do this? And this is not regulated, really. I mean, there is a set of rules and norms to how you do it.
Oh, really?
The fences go up at a certain time. You have to be in a certain area, otherwise you get kicked off. The police will go through, and if you look like you're drunk or you're too young or you're wearing, you know, protective clothing or something, you've got an iPhone or a camera, they'll police it in terms of the norms around. They don't want you to be a danger to other runners. But in terms of that, if you're over 18 or you look like you're over 18, you can actually stand up, you're not that drunk, and you roughly look like you know what you're doing, they will let you in there. And in fact, it's funny, when the bulls come and people try to get over the fences, you'll often see the police pushing people back onto the course. And it's a little bit of, you want to run with the bulls, you're going to run with the bulls. They do not actually let you crawl under or get over the fence unless there's a bull coming at you.
Wow. You know that you have to be at least 18 and not too drunk is a similar rule for the frats at Mizzou.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of things that should apply to.
did you have to run on the cobblestone part of the street? What's that like?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing, I mean, you're running through side streets and cobblestones, and there's curbs and things like that. And so getting used to the terrain, and then if somebody falls down in front of you, you got to jump them. And so it's a challenge. You're trying to sprint through a side street with a bunch of animals in what's a 30-foot-wide corridor. It's pretty challenging, and sometimes there's doorways you can duck into, sometimes there's not. Again, if the bull's coming at you, there's room in the fences for you to slip in between. But it's every man and woman for themselves when you're in there.
All right, last thing I want to ask you about, Liam, is the Flugtag. That's
a Flugtag, yeah.
A Flugtag. Excuse, I didn't know the German pronunciation of this.
Yes.
It's a word I've never said before or even read before. I picked up your book. Tell my listeners what this is.
Yeah, so it's Red Bull sponsors an event they call the Flugtag, which is German for Flying Day. And what it is they get teams of amateur people who construct what they call human-powered flying machines. Basically, you're constructing a glider with some loose guidelines, and then they have a contest where they pick a body of water. In my case, in Chicago, it was out on Lake Michigan. They construct a roughly two-story high by 100-foot runway or platform, and the teams go up there and they push their craft off of the runway, and you try to see who can fall or glide the farthest. So they do this probably a half dozen times a year. There's usually three or so in the U.S. They had one in Pittsburgh a few weeks ago. There's one in Nashville in a couple weeks. And it's, you're trying to build amateur flying craft. It's an amazing, it's kind of a cult event, but when we did it in Chicago, we went as the Flying Ditkas. You really can't go wrong in Chicago if you use Mike Ditka as your mascot and right. your clarion call there. And so we went as the Flying Ditkas. It was a Saturday. 75,000 people turned out on North Beach here in Chicago to watch this event. And I often say, you know, 3 months later when Barack Obama was elected president, he had a rally in Grant Park, and 50,000 people showed up. So if you can figure out, you know, 25,000 more people showed up to watch a bunch of idiots live gliders off of a ramp and showed up to watch President Obama. But it was a great, it's a great experience. My group, you know, we were a bunch of amateur engineers. One guy was in the military. So we actually put real thought into, we wanted to construct something that we thought might fly. And obviously nothing's really going to fly when it's created that way and you have to push it off something. So it's really a matter of how do you build the best crash lander you can. But it's a great experience. It's probably the closest I'll ever be to being a rock star. 75,000 people, you're on the Jumbotron. We were celebrities in Chicago for a month before and after that event.
It's a great story. Just one of those included in the book, The Best Year Ever. One guy, 1 year, 12 once-in-a-lifetime adventures. The man who lived those adventures and writes about it in this book is Liam Caffrey. Thanks so much for joining me here today, Liam.
Paul, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.